I don't know.
Juneteenth. Everyone celebrating.
Yeah. And then those of us in the Zendo will, or the Dirt Zendo will introduce ourselves. So let's start with Rosemary. Paulette.
Paulette.
Brian.
Brian.
Vin.
Vin.
Pat.
Pat.
Jeff.
Jeff.
Bob.
Bob.
Sage.
Sage.
And in the Dirt Zendo.
Shoketsu.
Shoketsu.
Dennis.
Dennis.
Warren.
Warren.
Jim.
Jim.
Dave.
Dave. Domio.
Domio.
All right. In terms of announcements, for those of you who will be here on Tuesday for the Tuesday class about studying the self, just a reminder that you might want to follow my recommendation to take an Enneagram test. That's a personality sorting mechanism, and I'm not saying that it's the best one in the world or that any of them are, like, nothing is inherently real, right? But it's kind of an interesting tool to just get yourself thinking about, you know, yourself and reflecting on that. So even if you kind of disagree with the questionnaire or how it sorts you or something, you know, it gets you thinking about it. And there is a great book. I don't have the author at the tip of my mind, but I'll try to post it on the website. So this is also under Tuesday Study. There's a link there to, you know, to an Enneagram information and a poll test. And there's a book that's called, I think it's like The Spiritual Dimension of the Enneagram. And that's one of the things I really like about this system, is that every type is presented as having certain tendencies which can manifest in a neurotic way and then can manifest in kind of, we would say, an enlightened way. So there's no inherent, you know, each type has its own unique challenges, but then its own unique strengths. So I'm gonna check that out. Next Sunday, so I will be here Tuesday. Next Sunday, I won't be here again, and I apologize for that. But there will be, out at Great Vows End Monastery, the monastery not far away where I've spent many, many years going to Sesshin, they're going to have a big ceremony out there called a mountain seat ceremony for Chozen Beis, who was one of the founders of the monastery, and she will be formally installed as the abbess. And this is a big step for a monastery, a Zen monastery. It's like, I don't know, it's kind of like a coming of age for a monastery, where obviously it's been functioning as a monastery for 20 years now. But this, to formally install an abbot with a mountain seat ceremony, has this implication, like, all right, now we are here for generations. Because this abbot, you know, ascends the mountain, and then presumably at some point there's actually descending the mountain ceremony, and then a new abbot or abbess ascends. So there's this sense that a real formal lineage of abbots is going to be established there. So that's an exciting thing for all Soto Zen folks, that this Soto Zen monastery is going through this step. And it's official Japanese thing too. So there'll be all kinds of Japanese monks there, and it'll all be like a big to do. So anyway, I am going out there to stay, you know, there's a tea or something on Saturday, and I'll stay Saturday night, and then Sunday, while you guys will be meeting, I will be attending that ceremony. So I will report back. But fortunately, you get a great guest speaker, Thomas Bruner, who has given talks to us before. He's a Dharma brother of mine from Dharma Rain Zen Center. And I'm not sure what he's going to talk about yet, but I'm hoping that he'll get the topic out so that I can go into the newsletter that will go out on Friday. So he will be here giving you the talk. And then I will be back one more Sunday, and then we'll be into the month of July. And I will give the first Sunday talk in July. That's July 3rd. But then we're going into calling it Sangha Voices. It's Sangha Voices Month. I will be on sabbatical, emphasizing reading and listening and reflecting instead of generating material the way that I usually do, pretty constantly for Bright Way and for the podcast. And that's people have signed up throughout the month to lead the Tuesday classes and give the Sunday talks. So there will be a schedule. I'm not sure if we'll post that or not, but basically each time you show up, it'll be a new Sangha voice that you will be hearing from. And it's a great way to get to know Sangha members and for Sangha members to give something of themselves to the Sangha. So I know, it's attendance tends to be lighter in the summertime as we all start to travel and everything like that, but it will be greatly appreciated whenever you can attend in the month of July in order to help create Sangha and support Sangha and support people who are stepping forward to keep this container going, even though I'm not here. So, and then let's see. July 9th, it's a Saturday, 4 to 6 p.m., there will be a local Sangha picnic for those of you who are in this area. That'll be at Cedar Hills Park. So it'd be wonderful to see some of you who, you know, aren't able to come because of COVID concerns. Maybe we can meet in the park and we can be socially distanced and, you know, eat together, play some music, play some games, chat. So that park is not very far away from Bright Way Zen, and there is already information in the newsletter and on the website about that. So if you look for July 9th. And that is all I can think of at the moment. Any questions or additional things that I should announce? I'm thinking that the Sangha picnic probably wouldn't be yet, just like a kind of a bring your own food thing, but bring something to share if you want, I think. Just because, I don't know, some people might just want to be COVID safe and not touch anything, and I don't know. I'm open to suggestions, but certainly if you want to, like, you know, bring a dessert to offer to people or something like that, please do. All right. Okie doke. So today's talk. Is on Juneteenth and our need for one another. So as I imagine, most of you are aware, today is actually June 19th. It's actually Juneteenth today, our newest federal holiday. So today I wanna say some things about it and its significance. And then talk about, I guess, certain aspects of Buddhist teachings and practice that encourage us to care about this, basically. Why should we be paying attention? So, and I, as a white person, I want to invite anyone here today who identifies as a person of color to, at any point, raise your hand, correct anything I say, or add your own comments or anything. So, but I hope what I say today will be relevant to everyone, no matter your racial heritage. But I want to acknowledge that our Sangha, like the vast majority of convert Buddhist Sanghas in the West, is composed mostly of white people. And I'm confident that every white person in our Sangha is well-meaning and agrees that racism is a tragedy. But we do also tend to be ignorant about the true scale and impact of our racist history, and that's of our country's history and our world's history, and largely blind to the ways that racism continues in force today. And this is why our Sangha periodically offers a six-course, it's not even really a class, but I guess it's a series that you go through with a cohort of people called Awakening to Whiteness. We've done the course twice and plan to do it again. And no one is excluded from participating in this series, but the point of it is to educate those of us who are white about our racial karma, about what it means to belong to a group of people who is classified as white and the kind of things in the past that it's part of our racial karma. So this is a neat quote from a Dharma teacher who went through a similar series and beautifully expressed how this goes hand in hand with our Buddhist practice. Because this Awakening to Whiteness and the series that this Kristen Barker went through is specifically made for Buddhists. So there are various forms of this series, but this one is specifically tailored to Buddhists. She says, the truth is that I didn't know. So she's a white person. The truth is that I didn't know I was suffering. The understanding of deep interdependence means that operating in a culture that objectifies, exploits, and oppresses, even and especially when hidden from the dominant view, divides the heart against itself. The upside of facing our own racism is so much greater than I knew. So much greater than just accepting the hard truth like a bitter pill. I submit that the upside isn't even to do less harm to people of color, although that is a necessity. The upside is wholeness. I have found that just as promised, if I can turn toward the suffering of racism, against my ego's self-protecting tendencies, I do experience pain, yet come to suffer less. So before I get started, I'll just say, if you are a white person and you would like to help organize another Awakening to Whiteness series for our Sangha, and I think the last time it happened all in the cloud sendo, right? All by Zoom. So this includes anybody. You can contact me either the email on the website or domio@brightwayzen.org. And there's a curriculum. So there's instructions and a curriculum and whatever. So it's not, whoever facilitates it is not leading it. They're just helping to coordinate it and everybody goes through it together. And if you are a person of color listening to this talk live or as a recording, I invite you to contact me if you would like to give a talk to our Sangha. And it wouldn't have to deal with race, although of course it could, because no amount of well-intentioned activities by white people will challenge, mature, and expand our consciousness beyond the limitations of whiteness, as well as simply listening to voices of people of color. So with that then, I'm going to briefly, for any of you who are unfamiliar, and I have to confess, you know, when I did this research this morning, I learned things. If you are unfamiliar with Juneteenth, so I looked up the information. This was on the National Museum of African American History and Culture website. So January 1st, 1863, Emancipation Proclamation freeing slaves in the rebelling states. So those who were in rebellion against the Union. It didn't free slaves that were in the Union states. So there were still a couple of Union states that it didn't. Slaves weren't actually freed until later. But it took a while, first of all, for the information to spread, but also it wasn't until the Union troops got, you know, reached all the way to the furthest west state, which was Texas, and enforced the Emancipation Proclamation, that slaves were actually free. So on June 19th, 1865, Union General Gordon Granger arrived in Galveston, Texas. And that's believed the last bastion within, again, there was still some slaves in the Union states, but within the rebelling states, that was the last slaves were freed. So, then it wasn't until the 13th Amendment, December 6, 1865, that slavery was ended everywhere. And then the 14th Amendment provided citizenship, due process, and equal protection. And the 15th Amendment provides the opportunity to vote and hold office. So a lot of states, and I'm not an expert on this, like I said, but a lot of states had their own Emancipation Days, you know, as the Union troops went and liberated slaves in those states. But then June 19th has been celebrated, starting in Texas for as early as 1866, so the very year afterward. And it has been a tradition beginning with Texas by proclamation in 1938 and by legislation in 1979. And then each state and the District of Columbia have formally recognized the holiday in some way. So for many of us, I think this has just kind of come into our consciousness fairly recently, but it's been around a long time. Called the longest running African-American holiday by some, or America's second Independence Day. And there's a historian, Mitch Katchen, who says he sees these celebrations of the end of slavery as having three goals: to celebrate, to educate, and to agitate. It says early celebrations consisted of baseball and fishing and rodeos. African Americans were often prohibited from using public facilities for their celebrations, so they were often held at churches or near water, and often characterized by elaborate large meals and people dressing up. So if anybody here has actually has a tradition of celebrating Juneteenth, I'd love to hear more. For those of us who don't, who are white, or we don't have a tradition of this, why should we care about this day? Is it somebody else's holiday? So there are many Buddhist teachings and practices that I can think of that ask us to pay attention to and care about and empathize with and respond to the experience of our fellow human beings. Of course, there's the Bodhisattva vow. Beings are numberless, I vow to free them. And our Buddhist literature is full of descriptions of different Bodhisattvas who help in all kinds of different ways. So there's, you know, I've shared some of that in Dharma Talks and on my podcast. You know, the Avatamsaka Sutra describes Bodhisattvas that do all kinds of different things. So it's not just that they're Buddhist teachers or whatever, but, you know, sometimes they're just helping beings. You know, do you need food? Do you need water? Do you need supplies? Do you need clothes? Do you need whatever? So meeting basic needs. Others are, constructing bridges, and others are punishing wrongdoers. And, like, there's all different kinds of ways that Bodhisattvas are active in the world. So Bodhisattvas do not retreat into peace until every last being is likewise liberated. So that's, and as I've talked about many times, this isn't just a matter of kind of moral obligation. In our tradition, it's seen as like, Who are you kidding? You can't truly be spiritually liberated as long as you're like leaving people behind. That's just not compatible with true enlightenment and spiritual liberation. So it's not seen as like this extra nice thing you do. It's seen as like that is integral to practice. If you practice, then naturally this is what you are going to do. But I like to say the Bodhisattva never encountering anything, never, ever, ever says, that's not my problem. Then, of course, there's our precepts. Do not kill, cultivate, and encourage all life. Not cutting anything off. Do not be mean with dharma or wealth. Share understanding, give freely of self. There's our view of Sangha, which can have a limited view in terms of our Buddhist community, but also our larger community and all beings. A sense, once again, that this is not, that Sangha is essential to our practice. We are social beings. We cannot live without one another. There's so many things that we take for granted that we are completely interdependent and dependent on one another. We wouldn't, if nobody had taught us language, if nobody had exposed us to culture, and we wouldn't even have language. Our brain would work completely differently. Like almost everything that we identify as being human comes because of our relationships with other people. So therefore, you know, if we extend our idea of Sangha, it is so, I feel like this is something that is extremely underemphasized in our society, which I think is very tragic, is how, I mean, at one level, of course, we should have the rule of law and basic justice and basic equity and rights and all of those things. But sometimes the emphasis on that tends to detract from an even more pervasive, deeper level of interdependent need that we need to respect one another. We need to feel like the people around us value us, they see us, they respect us as a human being. They care, they're kind, they're generous. Like, we need this. This is why, you know, there's the emphasis on, like, you know, microaggressions and things like that. But instead of seeing that as kind of a negative, punitive thing, pointing out all the stuff you don't do wrong, if you think instead of how important it is, just everyone you pass on the street, everyone you encounter, to somehow convey respect and humanity and kindness. We need this. Like, that's not just a nice thing that we add on. That is so core and fundamental to, which is probably why our whole society, you might say our whole society is mentally ill right now, because we lack that in so many places. Or there's so many people going without that sense of being held and seen and respected, of having dignity. So in addition, just thinking of Buddhist teachings and practices that encourage us to turn toward these kinds of things is, of course, Kristen Barker's comment earlier that this is part of our self-study. Those of us who participated in Awakening to Whiteness, that was the most striking thing, was like, oh, I had no idea how much all of this is tied up in my sense of myself and my assumptions about the world, the things that I have relied on, the things that I've taken for granted. It's very inextricably. So it's like, you know, we may look at people of color and think, well, naturally race is very tied in with their sense of self. But no, like, it's like two sides of a coin, right? So it's just as tied in with a white sense of self, whether we're conscious of it or not, regardless of our deliberate views or our desire to be a just person. So one of the sweetest teachings, which I want to talk about today, that I think points us toward caring for one another in this way of turning toward these issues of, if you will, celebrating or at least being mindful of Juneteenth. And that's Dogen's Bodhisatta Shishobo, or Four Ways Bodhisattvas Embrace Living Beings. And I have a podcast episode on, several podcast episodes on this, but I think this is so central. So there's four ways. I'm just going to concentrate on the fourth one today, but I'll share. The first one is, these are Japanese terms, fusei, generosity or free giving. So that's pretty straightforward. Aigo, loving words or kind speech. Rigyo, beneficial action or helpful conduct. And I think one of the neatest and most important things about this is a from the Shishobo that where Dogen talks about. He defines this as acting skillfully to benefit all classes of sentient beings. That is, to care about their distant and near future, and to help them by using skillful means. So I love that, care about their distant and near future. Because a lot of times I think we have a limited sense of a bodhisattva as being somebody who if somebody suffering crosses your path, you know, you have a nice response. So it's a very in the moment, spontaneous kind of response to suffering that might be around you. So in other words, you don't have to think beyond that. You just go about your daily life, and just if something comes up, then you'll respond as a bodhisattva. But if you're caring about the distant and long-term well-being of beings, that takes a little more reflection, right? That takes a little more looking out at our society and our systems and thinking about how suffering is perpetuated. And then caring about that and taking action in those realms as well. So then the fourth one is doji. And this is a little harder to translate, sometimes translated as cooperation, but do means the same. And ji means thing or matter or task. So same task. Same matter. So Nishijiman Cross, the translators, suggest a number of different translations, literally meaning identity of task or identity of purpose, sharing the same aim, or even the colloquial expression being in the same boat, which is my favorite way of putting this. Being in the same boat with all living beings. So Dogen says, this is the direct quote from Shishobo, identity action, or doji, means non-difference. It is non-difference from self, non-difference from others. For example, in the human world, the Tathagata took the form of a human being. From this, we know that he did the same in other realms. When we know identity action, self and others are one. So obviously, to be in the same boat with living beings means letting go of our sense of separateness from them, including our sense of competitiveness or the delusion. This is kind of the fundamental human issue, right? The delusion that our long-term well-being can come at the expense of others. So I like how this is, that usually in Buddhism we emphasize what we should stop doing or the delusion we should let go of, rather than here's an ideal and get yourself all worked up and try to like match that ideal and judge yourself compared to that ideal. So all we need to do is non-difference, like drop the delusion of difference or competitiveness or separateness. That is what we are adding to the situation, where the reality of the situation is we are all in the same boat, right? We don't have to like, well, I'll go ahead and I'll go get in the boat and be in the same boat with other beings. It's like, no, you already are in the same boat with other beings. Just drop the delusion that you're not. So non-difference with beings is the actual state of affairs. So it's important, though, of course. So non-difference, another way to translate it, is not being contrary. But of course, this doesn't mean being a doormat or failing to hold appropriate boundaries. It's recognizing we all share the same aim to seek happiness and avoid suffering. But if we're in it's the same boat with living beings, we're also in the boat. And if somebody's acting in a harmful way, I mean, there's other people in the boat too, right? So we need to kind of look out for everyone. So it's not that we, give up our discrimination in terms of what is harmful and not. So here's a very interesting section of the Shishobo. So he's talking about this identity action. And then there's a kind of obscure passage, which I'll read and then kind of explain, at least my understanding of it. So he says, lute, song, and wine are one with human beings, devas, and spirit beings. Human beings are one with lute, song, and wine. Lute, song, and wine are one with lute, song, and wine. Human beings are one with human beings. To understand this is to understand identity action. So this seems a little obscure. I mean, it's not often that bodhisattvas are encouraged to like rock out or get intoxicated. So like bodhisattva, what lute, song, and wine. But I was reflecting on it. And I think what he's pointing us to is the fact that lute, song, and wine are human creations meant to break down barriers between people and help them connect. So I like to think even of, if there's some spiritual hermit off in the wilderness, meditating and being very holy. Maybe she imbibes some sake, plays some music, recites some poetry, may find her heart softening toward living beings. Because there's a way that we can almost hold ourselves too apart and holy instead of entering into that sense of connectedness. So I thought if I had to paraphrase this Dogen section, what would I say? I'd say human beings have many ways of creating heartfelt, sincere connections with one another and with nature and with the divine. These ways of connecting arose because our connection wants to be expressed and experienced. So you might say when we try to connect, we point toward the reality of our sameness. Or that our sameness caused the ways of connecting to be created. To see beings reach out to one another in their loneliness means to understand being in the same boat with other beings. So with that in mind, I want to share. I guess I should have set up share screen already, but and I need to share sound. Okay. Is that big enough?
No.
All right. Okay. I think You should be able to hear. I can't see people, so I'll have to... Oh, hold on. Let me tell you. First, this is often referred to as the Black National Anthem. Lift Every Voice and Sing was a hymn written as a poem by NAACP leader James Weldon Johnson in 1900, and his brother, John Rosamond Johnson, composed the music. And then it was shortly after that, it was performed for the first time. And then it also became very prominently used as a rallying cry during the civil rights movement. So, Dogen continues. The task of identity action or cooperation means concrete behavior, a dignified attitude, and a real situation. There may be a principle of after letting others identify with us, then letting ourselves identify with others. The relations between self and others are, depending on the occasion, without limit. So to me, this says, this is not just about feeling. This is about acting from a place of conviction, concrete behaviors and real situations. So I thought it was telling that when I looked up the NAACP page on Juneteenth, it was a very brief description. And then it said, freedom is a thread and a fight woven through this nature's history and current political climate. Continue to take action to celebrate and ensure true freedom for all through awareness of racial disparities, mobilization, and bold actions necessary to further the fight for social justice and equal opportunity. And then there are links for ways that you can take action and get involved in the fight to cancel student debt, defend voting rights, and advocate for an inclusive economy. So Dogen continues, the ocean does not exclude water. That is why it is large. The mountain does not exclude soil. That is why it is high. A wise lord does not exclude people. That is why he has many subjects. That the ocean does not exclude water is identity action. Water does not exclude the ocean either. This being so, water comes together to form the ocean. Soil piles up to form mountains. So as I said earlier, the teaching is usually about what we shouldn't do, or like what we need to let go of doing. In this case, excluding. So as white people might have a delusion that racism is a problem faced by people of color. It's their issue. Juneteenth is a cause for African Americans to celebrate. Reality is what we want to wake up to. This is our foundational approach. The truth is liberating, even if it's sometimes difficult to face. Our practice can't progress as long as we dwell in delusion. Another precept, in the realm of the intrinsically pure Dharma, not harboring delusions is the precept of not becoming intoxicated. The reality, as Martin Luther King said so well in his letter from Birmingham jail, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. So that's about all I have to say today. I want to close by saying that it can be scary to foray into any sensitive cultural issue today, whether that's racism or cultural appropriation, trans rights, you know, the list goes on, because the backlash can be severe when we make mistakes, when we say something insensitive, when we forget something, we're ignorant of something, where it's a little terrifying. But this is part of my husband's wisdom. He reflected that, like, okay, that may be so. But, you know, kind of the pendulum swings, and like a few decades of having to be really, really careful about what you say and getting pounced on when you make a mistake is like really not that big a price to pay for trying to heal, you know, hundreds of years of oppression and violence. So it's, you know, I guess it's just something that we gotta tolerate and learn to deal with, and hopefully still engage and still try to learn. I know that was one of my biggest takeaways from the Awakening to Whiteness class was, I guess, I kind of knew, maybe I just knew where more of the landmines were, but I didn't feel like, oh, now I'm competent. But I just felt like it's still worth, and I can just apologize, right? I can just say, I didn't know, wow. Because you can't learn unless you go into this territory. So I want to open it up then. If you have questions or comments, please share. But in particular, maybe reflect on how does justice figure into your practice? Whether you've thought about that as a, you know, you've tried to integrate it explicitly, or whether you have your Buddhist practice, but you also have your concerns for justice, but I'm guessing there are ways in which they're certainly not incompatible, and maybe ways that your practice helps you engage with or face or deal with issues of justice. So feel free to raise your hand or come sit in the shoketsu.
So I took Awakening to Whiteness twice. The second time I facilitated it. And it was really eye-opening both times for me. One of the things I learned, I think between those two, the book How to Be an Anti-Racist came out. Mm-hmm. And I forget the name of the author. I was trying to look him up online, but I couldn't get online. Anyway, as a result of that, I have started receiving every day anti-racism daily. It's a newsletter that comes every day. You can get it weekly, whatever. And it's an ongoing education to me on issues all around that. You know, I have a long way to go, as we all do, but Anti-Racism Daily is really, I really recommend it.
Thank you.
Sure.
Dennis.
Maybe I can recant a story that kind of reiterates what you were talking about inadvertently saying politically incorrect things, you know, in an effort to be sensitive and try and understand situations for minorities. We had a group of friends over, four or five African-American people.
Speak up a little bit.
Sure. And somehow the conversation went, we were discussing something about being in a bad neighborhood. Mm. And that set off a whole lot of controversy. And I stepped in and said, well, yeah, it was a bad neighborhood. You know what a bad neighborhood is. And I got a lecture. And I just take a step back and say, yep, I get it. I understand. Mm. And that is a thing that it could be construed as derogatory. Yeah. You know? So there's a lot of those kinds of things. That, I mean, who knows what else is out there? And of course, you know, I'm always prided myself on being open-minded and liberal and all that. It's you just don't know. You know? You can't put yourself in the other person's shoes 100%. You never can. So.
Yeah, thank you. And I think that ability to graciously learn, and that I think that points also to what I'm trying to say about this. If the motivation is to be kind, is to be supportive and compassionate, if we return to that, it's not, our motivation shouldn't be, now I'm identified as I'm not somebody who's racist, or I'm not somebody who's sexist, or I'm not somebody who's insensitive. then we're likely to get defensive, right? And because that now this is jarring with our sense of ourselves. But if it's not about us, it's really about, really, I hadn't thought about that before, how you experience this. And then there's automatically like a, oh, you know, I don't want to say that or do that, or there's a sincere desire to create that sense of connection. I mean, one example that I can think of is I had the good fortune, it's been about 25 years now, I studied American Sign Language and, you know, and by extension learned a lot about deaf culture and the experience of deaf people, and ended up, I was the supervisor of a small crew, and I was involved with hiring, and we ended up in hiring a deaf woman. And I learned that sensitization to, you know, what I was able to learn how to put myself into the place of a deaf or hard of hearing person in a given situation and recognize, this is why, like, I'm kind of, we got to get a better system for, like, speaking the Zendo here, right? Because it's just, I know, like, it probably can be hard to hear somebody who sits in the Zendo and talks, and then now you're not connected, right? And you know, my dad's hard of hearing now, and oftentimes he'll just, you know, forget to put his hearing aids in, and it's just disconnecting. He'll just, everybody will be connecting and talking and sharing some kind of reality and idea, and he'll just be, you know, look like he doesn't care, because actually he can't hear. So it's just so much subtlety to that. It can be a little nerve-wracking trying to figure out all, because there's so much diversity these days, so many different ways people experience things. But if we keep on just returning to that, we want someone to feel connected. We want somebody to feel welcome. Yeah.
The name of that author is Ta-Nehisi Coates, in case anybody cares. It just came to me.
Sweet.
Ta-Nehisi Coates.
Anything else? Oh, Brian.
You know, so as we all know, there's no objective biological thing as race, right? So when you're losing your hearing, you know, that really is an attenuation of your ability to receive and process sound waves. You know, race is a thing that we did for politics and economics. And so one of the things I think, when I say we, I mean the world, and we wanted labor and to perpetuate a caste system to get it, that's we invented race. So one of the things that helps avoiding some of the sort of social faux pas that you can trip into is when you feel yourself inclined to, as we all do, kind of make a statement that's, you know, sounds race-based, is to wonder, you know, are there economics at work here? So bad neighborhoods are typically bad neighborhoods because they're capital deprived, right? I mean, they don't attract and get the capital to revitalize, and then that begets a whole series of, you know, sort of untoward social conditions. So I think, you know, and so blaming, you know, when you're a locution that appears to blame people who live in and can't get out of a community, or or choose not to, is, you know, that's a thing to avoid, but it's also implicit is the blaming of the people who are in that place for that place. And generally it's, you know, it's the politics and the economics that, you know, have gotten it in that position. So, anyway, I think, you know, there's some, I just finished listening to this guy, Adolph Reed Jr., who just wrote a book called South. And he's an active African-American activist and academic, and he's, you know, been around for a long time. And, but this was interesting because he's at retirement age now and is reflecting on what it was like to grow up just at the point when the Jim Crow South was changing over during the civil rights movement and afterwards. And so it gave him this perspective of the politics, the economics, and just the day-to-day texture of intergroup kind of relationships. And it was, it kind of awakens one to how complex all that is, but that underneath it, oftentimes there is these forcing mechanisms of politics and economics that, you know, gives us these unjust and unequal, you know, kind of societal results. Anyway.
Yeah, that's a great point. That, like, other kinds of, like, you know, like a disability, like being hard of hearing is in a sense a real thing that you have to deal with. And there's plenty of problems around our attitudes around those things. But yeah, like race and these other things, this is like, is something humans do. It's like all a creation of, this is our social thing. And I sometimes wish there was some way, I mean, it occurs to me, just throw this out there, as to convey the essence of the message. So a lot of times we end up with this seems like this ever increasing list of people we have to remember not to exclude, right? So we have race and we have gender identity and sexual orientation and we have disability and we have, you know, the list goes on and on about like be and, you know, indigenous people and, you know, so, but fundamentally what we're pointing at, I think we could summarize by saying all beings have but a nature, and all of these ways that we oppress and judge and exclude and keep people locked into systems of poverty and violence and everything, we are, as a society, we are breaking the first precept of we're not cultivating and encouraging life. We are doing violence to people's Buddha natures. So I feel like foundationally we would just say, like, any being, wherever they're born, whatever circumstances they're born into, however they look, whatever gender, you know, they are a Buddha. They are a potential Buddha. And to treat them as any less is just a horrible tragedy. So there you go. that's the Buddhist take on it. All beings have Buddha nature. So all right. Well, that takes us to the end of the day. I'll close with a verse. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas in the space of time. All honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. Thank you for being here.